Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Monday, June 15th. The Obama Presidential Center opens its doors to the general public this Friday. The former president arrived in Chicago over the weekend for a soft opening and walkthrough of some of the areas. Hawaii Public Radio was in the Windy City for a preview tour. We were the only media outlet from the islands to make the trip. And over the next few weeks, we'll be bringing you stories that will be unfolding about Barack Obama's life here in Hawaii, part of his journey to the White House. We also had a chance to sit down with the CEO of Hawaiian Airlines to talk about the oil crisis and the flap over branding as the two companies, Hawaiian and Alaska, merge into one, a work in progress. We also hear about loss and recovery at Otaki Camp on Oahu's North Shore, 3 months after the back-to-back storms that caused flash flooding. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This is a big week for Chicago. The Obama Presidential Center will be formally dedicated on Thursday, and its doors will open to the public the next day, Friday, Juneteenth. Former President Barack Obama's family and close high school chums are flying over to be part of the festivities. Hawaii Public Radio was able to get a sneak preview of the museum in Jackson Park earlier this month. It's located in the south side of Chicago, where the president found his calling. He met his future wife, Michelle, working alongside with her uplifting communities. The Obamas raised their two daughters there and still have a home in Hyde Park. To be honest, growing up over here on this side of the world, the only thing I knew about the south side was that line from a Jim Croce song, "Baddest Part of Town." But I got really curious about how the story about Hawaii would be told. The world knows Obama as the first African-American president, but it's more nuanced than that because Hawaii is also under his skin. Here's a clip of President Obama explaining his roots.
Who we are and where we come from shape our values and determine how we grow. Home can mean a lot of things. Think about where you call home and how it shaped you. My parents were from Kenya and Kansas. They met at the University of Hawaii. That's where I was born.
And Obama's parents' idealism about what's possible grounded him. Dreams, yes, and disappointments, too. It's not all black and white. We got a chance to sit down one-on-one with Valerie Jarrett, who spent the last decade working toward this week's grand opening. She's the CEO of the Obama Foundation and was senior advisor to President Obama for both his terms in office. Jarrett is also from Chicago. She says the $850 million investment in the neighborhood is long overdue. She recalled riding her bike through this historic park, which was the site of the World's Fair, the Chicago Exposition of 1893. We plan to explore some of that history in the weeks to come, but let's get to my conversation with Valerie Jarrett and the Obama Hawaii story that's told.
Well, as you know, President Obama thinks of Hawaii as home. He often talks about Hawaii and his zen-like personality that he thinks comes from his roots there and just the rich diversity of the island and its beauty.
Well, I know Michelle has said to understand Barack, you have to understand Hawaii and the nuances when it comes to race and discrimination and being an outsider. And, you know, I just walked through the first floor of the exhibit and there was a line that President Obama has put out there saying because of the strangeness of his heritage, it's like he belonged everywhere, yes, but belonged nowhere. And I think just that feeling of being an outsider or an observer, but that played a very big part in what he accomplished.
I think the empathy that he has from his life experiences allows people to see themselves in him. And he sees himself in them. It's a connection that he's able to make with people. And I think it's because he had this richly diverse background and he does fit in wherever he goes, but he also doesn't quite fit, if you know what I mean. He's able to fit, but it's his experience is so unusual Well, he talks about this in his book, that when he was in college, you know, he was really struggling with his race, and obviously as a, the world sees him as a black man, but it's more complicated than that.
I see him as a brown kid from Hawaii, a Hapa kid.
Yeah.
And what he represents is that, you know, any Hapa kid from Hawaii can become president of the United States.
Well, that's the hope, but that's what he, I mean, when you finish touring the museum, the message that I hope you will take away is that we tell the stories of ordinary people who do simply extraordinary things, usually working together. And that if you see yourself in that story, if somebody from Hawaii comes to visit and they see, you know, this photo of him out on the beach or, you know, in the waves, and they'll go, oh, that could have been me. That could easily have been me. And then they can see there are infinite possibilities. Not that they'll run for president, but that they can achieve whatever they want to achieve. And that's why this is not simply a time capsule for the past, but really an incubator for future leaders.
Well, you know, I spent part of the time rereading his books, and I got the audio book, now that it's available mm-hmm. as an audio book, of his first book, Dreams from My Father. And to hear that story told in his own voice mm-hmm. and to feel
powerful. Yes. I can imagine it's very powerful. And you could feel all of the mix of emotions that he must have gone through at that age. But yet underneath that all is truly this temperamentally very even keel human being who is deeply sensitive and empathetic and perceptive and curious. And I think some of that came from his Hawaii roots as well.
Well, you know, I was sitting there in the auditorium earlier in the morning thinking about a sense of place, because mm-hmm. I know the South Side means a lot to you and everybody else that was a part of this team that put this center together. But Hawaii was in the running for it, and I know people were disappointed that we're not opening there, but it's here. But I was just thinking this week, you know, maybe this was the place where it was supposed to be.
I think we are exactly where we belong. And there is just something very special about the South Side of Chicago. And symbolically, the investment that we're making here will have a ripple effect that will profoundly affect thousands and thousands of lives. And we've already hired 5,000 people to do construction work who now have that on their resume, and it will be a great calling card for their next job, the permanent jobs that we're creating here. The spotlight that we're putting on a part of the city that has not enjoyed investment historically, hopefully will people say, well, if Barack Obama, who could have chosen anywhere in the world to put his library, chose to put it here, must be a pretty special place. And indeed it is. I grew up here. And so in a sense, we're revealing what those of us who are from Chicago have always known, which is this is a really special community.
And when you go to visit Hawaii there, do you get a sense of, you know, how that helped shape the man that he became?
Yes, because my observation when I have been with him in Hawaii is it's almost like he can exhale. There is a peace that comes over him, a sense of tranquility and gentle spirit. It's like a wave that comes over him. And he is as comfortable there as I've seen him anywhere. It's home.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing the water terrace that was created in honor of his mother.
It's beautiful. It's not quite finished, but you can see it. It's ask when you get over there, because it's kind of in the middle of a construction area, but it's spectacular.
Yeah. Well, what else would you like to share with our Hawaii listeners about that part of the president?
I think Hawaii is always next to his heart. And it is where he came of age. And it shaped him profoundly. I think coming from a mixed race parents and his mom, who traveled with him all over the world, influenced him to be a citizen of the world with deep roots in Hawaii. And I think that will always be there. You can't take the Hawaii out of Barack Obama.
Well, I know when, you know, as part of that exhibit, he talks about, you know, his roots in Kenya and in Kansas, mm-hmm. and, you know, how that has just grounded him in a way that it's hard to explain to people. You know, I actually came across somebody here at the park, and she wasn't aware that his mother was white. You know, so it's just a wonderful, you know, revelation for her when she comes to see this and to know that part of history.
That's so interesting. You would think by now people would know all there is to know about Barack Obama. but I think all of that adds to the dimensions of who he is as a human being. And I think it's what allowed him to give the speech he gave at the Democratic Convention in 2004, where he talked about, you know, we're not a blue states of America or red states, we're the United States of America. And it's because he really does search for what we have in common and not what divides us. That's temperamentally who he is, philosophically who he is, intellectually who he is. And I think a lot of that came from Hawaii.
Well, you know, we are going through some very difficult times now politically. We are more divided than ever. But how do you see this opening against the backdrop of the geopolitical situation, you know, given your experience in the White House?
Well, first of all, are we really more divided than ever? I can think of some pretty difficult times in our nation's history where we were pretty divided. Slavery, for example. When women couldn't vote, for example. When people couldn't marry whoever they loved. So I think we have made a lot of progress in the country, and progress takes time, and it takes a sustained effort over time. And it happens incrementally. And democracies are not self-executing. I think they're... this campus is designed for people to come and appreciate the power that they have to be these mighty forces for good and to go forth and do so. And maybe that's more important than ever in a time where there's so much division and divisiveness and toxicity in social media, for example. And part of what we say to our leaders is you can control what you can control. And so if you behave a certain way, then it sets a tone for how, what kind of a leader you're going to be. And I think Barack Obama, when he was, well, not just Barack Obama as a human, exudes integrity and character and empathy and goodness of spirit. And now he wants to be a coach. And so if he can take what he learned in Hawaii and because of his diverse background and his extraordinary education and his life experiences and help the next generation of leaders, well, then that's a success.
When I think of Hawaii, I think of, you know, the humbleness mm-hmm. of the people. And I would like to think that he, that's a part of his value system.
Yes.
And you know, some might say in this current administration, that's not a part of their vocabulary, but I don't know, the juxtaposition of somebody who, you know, is humble and is interested in pulling people up, I guess, bringing communities up. It's a stark contrast to a time we're living in now.
Well, I'll say a couple of things. Both Michelle and Barack Obama believe to those who much is given, much is expected. And they have devoted their life to service. This has never been about him. It's always been about how he could be a force for good. And I think what we have tried to do in the midst of a turbulent time is to create space for people to see that we really do have a lot in common, that our stories are connected, that we can see ourselves in each other's stories and find things that we can share. And, you know, I said earlier, if two people are admiring a piece of art, but they have completely different backgrounds and perspectives, they might see something different in that art. And I hope they share it with each other. And they go, oh, well, I hadn't seen that, or I hadn't thought about that. And that's the magic that we're trying to create here. But it's revealing what's already there. And I guess that's kind of the point I'm making is that I think most people are really good people. They're really decent people. And we get caught up in kind of the news of the day, and here we have the luxury of focusing on the long term. We're investing in people today who may not take leadership, who may not occupy leadership positions for a while to come, but we're helping them on that road. And that's such a luxury to be able to focus on the long term, as opposed to the here now where I really can't control it, right? And so I think that's what our role is now. Our role is to prepare the next generation and give a gift to the south side of Chicago that puts a spotlight on a part of the city that has not enjoyed investment for far too long, and encourage people from all around the world to come and visit and see for themselves. So for those who are unsure, well, just come on. You did. Get on an airplane and come on over. And I promise you, you won't regret the visit.
All right. Thank you. Valerie Jarrett, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for coming. Appreciate you being here.
And that was Valerie Jarrett, CEO of the Obama Foundation, who we got a chance to sit down with in Chicago during a media preview of the Obama Presidential Center earlier this month. We will have more stories in the days and weeks to come.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Tune in to HPR2 on Sunday at 3 p.m. to hear the internationally acclaimed vocal ensemble Apollo 5 at the Cathedral of St. Andrew in downtown Honolulu. We'll hear iconic works by Alec Roth, Orlando Di Lasso, William Byrd, and Benjamin Britten, as well as modern favorites including Summertime by George Gershwin and Fly Me to the Moon by Bart Howard. That's Sunday at 3 p.m. on HPR2.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters, featuring barrel-aged Marugohipe with a flavor profile of dark chocolate and orange bitters at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com or at their cafe in Hilo.
The war in Iran and the squeeze on oil and the rising fuel costs are dominating the headlines. We had the opportunity on Friday to sit down with the new CEO of Hawaiian Airlines, Diana Burkett-Racco. She dropped by our studios to talk about how the Alaska Air Group is navigating through the energy crisis as it works toward integrating the systems and unions between Hawaiian and Alaska.
So, yes, we are in, frankly, a crisis around fuel prices, jet fuel prices, and they are about double what they were prior to the Iran war, and we're navigating that. And what that means for us is that based on the amount of fuel that we burn, every dollar increase over the prior sort of fairly steady price of fuel is about $100 million a month in additional cost. And right now we're running about $2 a gallon above pre-war prices. So that's about $200 million extra a month. We have increased our fares sort of here and there in order to offset some of the cost of that cost increase. But I will tell you, we're not recouping the full cost of increased fuel. So we're trying to balance that. The way that we have been thinking about it from the perspective of local travelers here in Hawaii, both for Neighbor Island and for the continent, is that's the value of the Huaka'i program. So the Huaka'i program is available. It's a part of our loyalty program, Huaka'i by Hawaiian, and it's available for all Kama'aina, all Hawaii residents, to sign up. And it includes a bag benefit, it includes discount on Neighbor Island travel, it includes monthly system-wide deals. So those monthly deals will vary across different routes, but it's a way to help local people who are truly dependent on travel, you know, mitigate the cost of travel and tailor how they want to use those benefits to when they want to fly. So it is a difficult time in the cost profile of our industry. And hopefully we will get to a more level place in, you know, a few months from now. But that's sort of how we're balancing it today.
Are you seeing travelers maybe change their mind about flights they may have booked?
We're actually seeing pretty steady demand. We actually have about 7% more seats in the market this summer than we did last year. And we're seeing still pretty healthy, steady demand for air travel. So I think people are choosing to travel. It's something that particularly after COVID, people have prioritized in their lives, whether it's, you know, experiences or staying connected with friends and family. And, you know, I think we all recognized when we weren't able to travel how valuable that is. So we still are seeing people travel and, you know, we'll continue to sort of watch that profile.
We've been, you know, seeing the headlines across the country where lots of flights are canceled. And, you know, I don't know if you folks have had to do that with Hawaiian and Alaska. You know, fortunately, a lot of the areas that you do fly out of, those are the travelers who like to come to Hawaii.
Yeah.
But I don't know. What can you share with us?
We haven't actually pulled back capacity at this point and really staying focused on our long-term strategy. We will be doing probably, and we have done a little bit on the continent, some what we call fringing or changing flights here and there. But we haven't done very much of it, and we haven't done it in Hawaii to this point.
And then what about expansion plans? I know we were chatting earlier about flights to Guam, and I know the governor of Guam, I think, has asked, you know, hey, we would love to have some competition. You know, there's just one airline pretty much that flies through there. And I was surprised at how much one ticket was from Haneda to Guam. It was $3,000, and it was non-refundable. You know, so those are pretty eye-popping numbers. But yeah, anything you can share on that front? Or?
Right now, I would say two things. One is, and you know, every time I'm flying, I get a chance to talk about this with the flight attendants. But we need to stabilize and make sure that we have a really strong foundation for our network as a whole, everywhere across our system, but especially to, from, within Hawaii. Prior to coming together, Alaska and Hawaiian, Hawaiian was losing a significant amount of money year over year or in that year. And we were able to cut those losses in half. That's a great progress. And being able to get to a place of profitability enables you to invest in new routes, new expansion. We've taken a little bit of a step back just here with the fuel costs, but we've got a great underlying trajectory. And so I'm really optimistic about the future. But right now, the focus is on stabilizing that base. In our broader system, there's two things that have changed to expand our reach. One is that we are growing our international reach out of Seattle eastward into Europe. And we just launched 3 flights here in the last month over to Europe, direct from Seattle to London, Rome, and Reykjavik. And it's actually the fastest one-stop connection, the fastest connection to Europe from Hawaii, because you would need to go north. And as the crow flies, you'd fly right over Seattle. We've got about 300 people a month that are traveling now between or planning to travel between Hawaii and Europe via that connection. And we're really excited to serve those passengers. And we just got started. So we look forward to that number growing as more people become aware of that connection and as we get into summer travel. The other thing I'd highlight is we joined the One World Alliance here at the end of April when all of our systems came together for more seamless travel. And what that means is that as an Atmos Rewards member or a Huaka'i by Hawaiian member, you get to earn and redeem points on a set of 17 airlines across the globe. So think of it as an expanded virtual network, not just Hawaiian Airlines, not just Hawaiian Airlines and Alaska Airlines, but Japan Airlines, Qantas, British Airways, Fiji, Philippine Airlines just joined last weekend. So really getting to expand our reach around the globe. So those are a couple of ways that we're continuing to provide new options for our guests.
And then what about between the neighbor islands? You know, I know I think you were on Molokai.
I was on Monday
as well. Yeah, because I know that, you know, they've got a challenge there with their situation. But they also have a short runway. And
they do.
And there's some people may want you there and other people don't. You know, they don't want more visitors. And so there's that push and pull, that tension in the community. But again, you know, just the need for an alternate airline.
Yeah, so we're very committed to neighbor island travel, as you know, with very high frequency and service and continuing that. We can't serve Molokai with the aircraft that we have due to the short runway. And so what we do focus on is how do we support the flying that our partners at Mokulele do? How do we make sure that they are as reliable in their operations as possible? And I know they've been working to improve those operations significantly, and we encourage that progress and we'll continue to work with them to make sure that it continues.
Okay, but at this point, then...
There isn't really a direct option for us. But the reason that I was there on Molokai, and I actually went alongside a leader from Mokulele, was to listen to the community, make sure that I understood and appreciated what they go through to travel for education, for healthcare, what their interests and priorities are, what their concerns are about the reliability of the operation right now. And I think the reliability has made a lot of progress over the last year, still room to improve. But that's something that we're going to continue to watch. And our role as the major provider of transportation on the islands is, even if we can't serve that particular community, to make sure that we understand the need and make sure that we are working with our partners to find solutions.
That was Hawaiian Airlines CEO Diana Burkett-Rakau. We'll have more of this conversation right after a short break.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
Two of network's biggest news shows made news this week. The president stormed out of an interview with NBC's Meet the Press.
Let's call it quits because I've had enough.
And fired 60 Minutes correspondent Scott Pelley had words for CBS's new management.
There was a thumb on the scale for the president's version of events.
We go behind the headlines on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. Contemporary jazz saxophonist Dave Kaz performs tomorrow through Thursday with songs such as Careless Whisper and Together Again. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Let's continue our conversation with the new CEO of Hawaiian Airlines, Diana Burkett-Rakau. How do you delineate Alaska and Hawaiian under one company, whether it's meals or uniforms?
What can you say about branding? Because, you know, we're hearing lots of chatter around the thing with no flowers in the hair, or explain the situation.
Yeah,
with that.
I'm so glad that you asked. So we are doing something that no other U.S. airline has done. And it's a testament to the strength of the two brands that we have in our combined operation now that we are committed to this new business model, which is that we are one airline with one team. And from the guest perspective, it should be one seamless system now that our reservation systems are connected as of the end of April. But preserving and elevating, continuing to elevate two phenomenal, strong, and beloved brands, the Hawaiian Airline brand and the Alaska Airlines brand, you know, both with over 90 years of history. And what that means is that the Hawaiian Airlines brand is here to stay, focused to from within Hawaii, and that it will have a distinct and separate set of onboard service elements, uniform, etc., from the Alaska Airlines brand, which will have its own distinct uniform standards, onboard service elements, and feel. So what that means is that there has been some questions about flower inlay, and I can explain that. What I will say is that neither the Hawaiian Airlines or the Alaska Airlines uniform standards have changed at all. So for Hawaiian Airlines, if you're flying on the Hawaiian Airlines brand, anywhere that the Hawaiian Airlines brand flies, the uniform includes an opportunity to wear a flower or pua in your hair, to wear lei, use aloha Hawaii, and then obviously serve a very distinct service that evokes Hawaii. If you're on the Alaska Airlines brand, if you are traveling to or from Hawaii, you can wear flower and lei. If you are traveling outside of Hawaii, let's say from the West Coast to New York or Miami, then that's not part of the uniform. And that continues to be the case today. So the particular question came up around the Hawaiian Airlines global brand, which is actually being served by phenomenal Hawaiian Airlines originating flight attendants and crew. pilots, crew. From now, they can wear flower and lei if they're traveling to and from Hawaii. But on the Alaska brand from Seattle to, say, London, that's not part of the uniform standard, which is consistent with the rest of the Alaska uniform. The reason that we do that is because the ability for us to sustain these two brands in part relies on us holding them distinct and unique from one another.
Yeah, it's the identity.
And when you start blending, there is a risk that you actually lose that identity. So that's why we've made that decision and have had really good conversations with our employees about that decision. And it is on all of us to make sure that we continue to sustain and preserve and protect the Hawaiian Airlines brand. And this decision is consistent with that commitment.
Okay, and I do have to ask you, because I know we have done stories here about tattoos. And there was a lot of concern on behalf of our listeners about a story where I think it was a flight attendant or someone on the crew had a tattoo and I think lost her job over it. You know, and it was around the time that Moana, it was a big splash about Moana and Polynesian tattoos and branding and all of that. What can you clarify about that situation with tattoos and your crew?
I can't speak to that particular situation. What I will say is that both Alaska and Hawaiian over years have evolved their uniform standards. Historically, Hawaiian Airlines has not permitted visible tattoos. Alaska Airlines has permitted within certain bounds. And so as we come together, you know, we continue to look at what is appropriate for each of those brands as we go forward.
So has the policy changed at all?
You know, I'm not familiar with the details where the policy is headed right now.
Okay.
But we will continue to look at that.
All right. And then I know you've made some changes with your onboard meals, right? You aren't serving the complimentary meals, but you are offering a chance to purchase meals with a Hawaii tie.
Yeah. So one of the themes that we've heard from guests, and this goes back to long prior to when I was in this role, but one of the things that Hawaiian Airlines has heard consistently from guests and from flight attendants as well over time is dissatisfaction with the meal service in the main cabin. So it's great that there's a complimentary meal, but the quality of the meal and the opportunity for choices, including maybe a vegetarian or a vegan choice, was something that continued to be an area of feedback that we got. So Hawaiian Airlines had actually been looking at this prior to the combination. And one of the things that was unlocked when we brought our reservation systems together is technology that allows individual guests to pre-select a meal when they are getting on board. So what we decided to do is to work with a local chef, Chef Sheldon Simeon out of Maui, who has worked with us to design a menu that is based in Hawaii flavors, some of his family recipes, his grandma's mochiko chicken, and be able to bring those meals on into the main cabin experience. And so, you know, the trade-offs when you have multiple options is wanting to be able to make sure that guests can select an option. You can't just load a ton of options or else you're going to end up with a lot of food waste. So we do allow guests to pre-select an option up front, and it will be a meal for purchase rather than a complimentary item, just given the cost trade-offs of making sure that it's a really high-quality option with a lot of choices. And so that goes live on July 1st with pre-order obviously starting earlier for those flights starting July 1st. We brought our meals out to about 1,100 people across our system in Honolulu on the day of the announcement on May 28th. And Chef Sheldon was with us serving the meals. And it was really fun to be able to actually share the flavors with our employees. And I think folks really were excited about the quality of the food that we're able to bring to life on board with this evolution.
You take something away, but you give something as well.
Yeah. And the one thing that is really important is the idea and the grounding in Ho'okipa on board. That's a fundamental way that it's a brand value, and it's a fundamental way that our flight attendants show up day after day. And so the idea of being able to offer something complimentary to the guest is still very important. And so we're partnering with Diamond Bakery and Anahola Granola to offer complimentary snacks at the beginning of the flight, the traditional complimentary beverage pour, and then a sweet treat at the end of the flight. So that theme still exists, even though we have evolved the onboard service to offer a higher quality meal option and to offer greater choice.
Okay, so lots of changes abound. But I don't know, anything else that you would like to underscore to listeners and travelers out there?
I think the most important thing is, you know, and you mentioned a lot of changes. It has been a lot of change in the last few years, and we sincerely appreciate the commitment of our guests to give us feedback about what's working and what's not, as well as to be with us on this journey, because the goal of the journey is that we are able to keep Hawaiian Airlines connecting the islands and the globe for a long time to come. And that's what that's why we come to work every day. That's why our employees, you know, want to deliver great care to all of our guests and make sure that we are safe and reliable and delivering a wonderful experience on board and flying for Hawaii. That's why we do what we do every day. And so while there is a lot of evolution, it's in service of that ultimate goal, and we will continue to keep our eyes on that ultimate goal.
All right. Well, Diana, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Hawaiian Airlines' new CEO, Diana Burkett-Racco. We should note, Hawaiian Airlines is an underwriter of HPR. Drive by the Hawaii Convention Center, and there is construction scaffolding that screams, "Work in progress." Honolulu Star Advertiser's Allison Schaefer has been tracking the drama around the funding to fix the leaky roofs and other needed repairs. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning.
Yes. I mean, I drive by that convention center every single morning. So, yeah, you want it to get going and reopen again.
Well, they're trying to head in that direction. It's been leaking since about a year after it opened, so since the late 1990s.
Yes, and talk about the money that the convention center was asking for to make some of those repairs.
So because of all the deferred maintenance, the first major thing was a leaky rooftop terrace. And the legislature appropriated about $64 million for that a couple of years ago. That was just for that one project. And then as it waited, there was another leak that came up with the transom glass. That leaks another 20-something million. And then, of course, that's just leaks. You got to upgrade your carpet and your food and beverage and your digital signage, and you got to repaint. You got to do all these other things, which they've been doing some of it, but they had a punch list of about 20 items they wanted to do during the shutdown, so that when they reopened after the leaks, it would be fresh and new. Unfortunately, with the escalation and the leak costs to fix them, the rooftop repair project went from about $64 million to $87 million and perhaps over $110 million with contingencies. The convention center used some of the money that the legislature had given them from other upgrades towards that project. Then went back this year and asked for more money to fix the upgrades that they can't get to. And they were turned down. The ledge did agree to let them use some funding that they had in reserves to fix the transom glass roof, but I guess the end result is at the end of this two-year period, if nothing changes, you won't have any leaks, but you won't have any upgrades later. So, I don't know if what the marketing around, we don't leak anymore, come see us.
Yeah, and when it comes to things like replacing the carpet, right? I mean,
yeah, replacing the carpet, digital signage, Wi-Fi, things that have to do with the exhibitors, because the convention center already has a disadvantage in that people don't really equate Hawaii with the place to come to do work. Plus, the flights are more expensive and it costs more to ship everything for the shows. So, they have to work hard to address all of that. And they've been doing a pretty good job of that in the last several years. But you know, the facility wearing down doesn't help the case.
Yeah, and the state has not had a very good track record of maintenance, you know, and then, you know, that's why we're in the situation we're in. And you know, the costs are rising, right, for repairs and reconstruction.
Yeah, and everything you put off costs more later, which is what happened with the rooftop terrace repair. I mean, I remember when it was significantly less than the $87 million that it's going to cost supposedly now. And then, you know, the problem is when you look up under the hood, if it's been leaking since, you know, the first year of opening, there's things that they can't account for that are going to cost even more. You know, deferred maintenance just in the long run ends up being really, really expensive.
Well, I remember when they were talking about building the Hawaii Convention Center, right? It was going to be world class. And yet we're faced with this 2-year shutdown, and you want everything to be, you know, up to high standards.
Yeah, I mean, if world class is we don't leak, I mean, yeah, I think, you know, to be world class, a lot of the point in the visitor industry is you've got to offer something extra, not just the basics, right, that we don't leak anymore, because you wouldn't expect the convention center to leak.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll have to stay tuned and see how we get through the next 2 years. But thank you so much, Allison.
My pleasure. Aloha.
That was Allison Schaefer from the Honolulu Star Advertiser. You can read her story at staradvertiser.com.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
On the next Fresh Air, author Eddie Glaude on America at 2:50. We'll talk about his new book, America USA, and the story he says this country keeps telling about itself, from Frederick Douglass in 1876 to this 250th year, and what we choose to forget. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Age and income don't matter when it comes to supporting HPR. Whether you're 23 or 83, you can make a meaningful gift to HPR through your will, trust, or other estate plan. You can even name the station as a beneficiary of a life insurance policy or retirement plan. And when you do, let us know so we can recognize you in our Legacy Society. Learn more and get started at hawaiipublicradio.org/legacy.
Support for HPR comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the Daniel Kahikina Akaka VA Clinic, committed to design that serves and celebrates the environment, culture, and community. FerraroChoi.com.
It's been 3 months since Oahu's North Shore was hard hit by the back-to-back Kona low storms. HPR's Cassie Ordonio has been spending time up at Otaki Camp on the North Shore and joins us live. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and you know, I just feel for those families out there, because I've been out there reporting floods over the years, and it's scary, the power of the waters that come raging down in that area.
Exactly. And speaking of, you have reported back in Otake Camp, I believe, was it 20 years ago? I remember seeing that that video of you standing in the water. It's about maybe knee high.
Yeah, it's scary stuff for those families.
Exactly. And so when I got to spend time there, this was after the floods, and I was there when it was in soupy, cakey red mud, and then even went back there to where it was kind of like, it looked like a desert, where the mud was so cracked that it looked like a desert in a sense, and there was a lot of dirt and dust flying all over the place. But looking at Otake Camp now, it's still in ruins, and there's about 30 households, family households that are supposed to live there, but less than a dozen are left. So when you think about those less than a dozen, those are for the homes that are savable. And within those homes, you could still see some of like the mud lines, kind of like where the water levels were. Some are already cleaned out, but a lot of the residents there, they're still trying to get their furniture back in. They can't necessarily live in there yet. So either they stay with a family member or a friend or elsewhere, and then they come back to work on their home. And one resident who I got to speak to is Mark Apai, and he's been living at Otake Camp since he was 3 years old. He's 37 now. And he told me he's experienced five floods in his whole lifetime, his first time when he was 3 years old. And he chooses to stay on the property to help his neighbors.
It's so hard for me to walk away from this, you know, and a lot of people did walk away from it, but I can't do it. This thing brought me back from the dead kind of thing, you know, that's how I feel, because it's rough when it happens to you, you know, to think it could happen to you. You don't want to make this happen to you because it's really real, the trauma. You know, the can't sleep at night, I have that. You know, crying every morning, I go through that. And it just, the starting of my day is the tears that come out of my trauma.
Yeah, and so how he's feeling is how other residents are feeling. So they have this conflicted feeling of fighting to stay in the neighborhood that they grew up in, or just pack up and leave Otake Camp for good because they just can't deal with the floods anymore. That's a lot of cost damages to them. And speaking of cost damages, I know the FEMA deadline just passed just yesterday. And so when I was texting Mark actually this morning asking, hey, did you get your FEMA relief, along with another source I interviewed, Anthony Neary Jr., they both got their relief, but for Mark, it's not enough for him to rebuild his home that he was renting. Mm. And so when he was talking to his landlord, which is part of the Otake family, he asked like, hey, when are we going to rebuild my home? That hasn't been in conclusion yet. And so Mark's, at the end of the day, Mark is going to have to relocate elsewhere. But he's currently still staying on the property and living in a white food truck that was donated to him. And when I got to see his food truck, he stuck a futon in there and a TV. So he sleeps there during the day, wakes up, goes to work, and then comes back to help his neighbors clean up. Even though the reality is he can't move back home, he wants to make sure that his neighbors are getting the help that they need. But you know, Mark remembered his time growing up there, and, you know, he got that home just 12 years ago, and he was supposed to celebrate his birthday 2 days before the flood happened, actually. He was going to celebrate it in his home, and then the flood just swept away his home, and then his home crashed into that bridge downstream, and he was devastated.
I got flooded out twice before the third one hit. First flood didn't go in the house. Second flood went up to the second step. The third flood, I wasn't even going to wait for that because my girl had packed everything and I was working in Waimanalo and it was raining really hard. So she said, honey, go home and grab all the kids' stuff just in case. And we had emergency kits. But, you know, we came home to nothing. I thought my house is still going to be here and I thought I was going to be okay. But when you come home and there's nothing, you know, that's why I feel bad, because I didn't listen to her. And she made it so easy for me, and I wanted to take the shortcut to go to her mom's house to see her. And then that night I got the phone call from my brothers, one of them, and he said, our houses are gone. And this is like 1-2 in the morning, and it killed me, and it still kills me.
Yeah, I can hear the trauma in his voice.
He actually, when I went out there to spend time with him, talking to him, it might not sound like it right in this clip, but he seemed really put together. He was smiling. But once we got to his property and he found a case of his food bowls that he used to feed his seven cats, he just broke down crying. He couldn't like put on this facade anymore. Mm-hmm. And speaking of those seven cats, he only found three of them. So he's still looking for the rest of his cats, as well as like picking up the pieces. But we're kind of still left with the question of where are the rest of the residents, because I've only got to speak to two, although I saw a handful of others that were on site. But when I was talking to Marco Pai about it and Anthony Neri Jr., a lot of them don't know where they are. They'll see GoFundMes, but they've been hearing that some residents are just going to pack up and leave. Some are living on the continent. Others, just knowing Otake Camp, there's a lot of immigrant communities. Some are from the Philippines. Some are from Vietnam, Laos, and whatnot. A lot of them are just packing up and leaving while others are fighting to stay. And looking at Otake Camp, it's located in the Waialua neighborhood in North Shore. It's situated right on the edge of Kaukonohuna Stream, which is historically known to flood. And it's like right behind the grocery store called Te Otake and Sons, which is owned by the Otake family or the Otake family company. Just where it's located, it's been flooding for years. And when I went to the newspaper archives, looking at the Star Bulletin, the Honolulu Star Advertiser, there were so many newspaper articles that go back to 1955 of how many times it's flooded.
It's flooded, yeah, it's chronic.
Yeah, and it probably goes back even more. But the Otake family and even the Otake residents have been raising concerns to both the city and state and whoever they can complain to for years. A lot of them point the fingers at the city. Some people point the finger at the state. Others are pointing the finger at Dole. There's just a lot of, like, where's the accountability? That's what the residents have been telling me. But when I got to talk to Anthony Neri Jr., he was seeing the dredging. I believe it was the Department of Transportation who was on site that day when I went there, who was trying to widen the stream, going from 15 feet, and it looks about maybe 70, 80 feet when I was there. But Anthony Neri Jr. has told me that river has never been dredged before.
I've been living in Otake for 31 years. This river has never been dredged once since I moved in here in 95. But yes, the river is so close behind a lot of the units and stuff, and it's always a danger. People got to think about this. It's all the rainwater, all the runoffs from up Schofield all the way down to Waialua, all of that rainwater runoffs goes right into Otake Stream. So from Schofield to Waialua, anything that's raining and falling on Mount Kaala comes right down in Otake. So, you know, that's a lot of water for this river to handle. You know, now with the dredging that's being done, my goodness, that river's wide open. I feel it's going to take a lot for, you know, the water to get back up and to even reach my unit. Dredging-wise, that's going to be a really big help in the future.
And you also talked to the councilman out in that area, right, about what can be done?
I did. I did talk to Councilmember Matt Wire, who represents the North Shore area. Right now, he said he's waiting on the after-action report from the city administration, but there is a lot of talks on the stream ownership, the Kaukonohe stream ownership, because there's so many owners of that stream, the Otake family, private property owners, the city and the state, trying to be in compliance to make sure the stream is maintained so it doesn't flood in the future.
Yeah, no easy fix. All right, well, thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with HBR's Cassie Ordonio about recovery in the hard-hit Otake Camp on Oahu's North Shore. Find your coverage online at hawaiipublicradio.org. That does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to continue our coverage of the Obama Presidential Center. We do welcome feedback. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217. Did you know you can find the conversation as a podcast? Search for it on Spotify or Apple, or go on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.